This is an interview with Lou McNally. Today is Wednesday, April 2nd, 2014, and this is Adam Chile conducting the interview. So just to get us started off, Lou, I'm wondering if you can tell me how you got interested in your field. Lou, actually, I'm going to go ahead and stop. This is an interview with Lou McNally. Today is Wednesday, April 2nd, 2014, and this is Adam Chile conducting the interview. So, Lou, I'm wondering if we could begin by you explaining how you got interested in historical climatology.
Well, actually, it came from my interest back then. Old documentation, old newspapers and diaries and books and what have you, and the study of climate change, realizing that we don't really have much of an instrumental record going back very far, and we have a number of paleoclimatic proxies which go back considerable distances. I was hoping in my research to be able to make a little bit of an overlap, if you might, between the current instrumental record and the proxy records that we've got a hold of, and try to extend back the actual observational record, if you will.
Mm-hmm. In what field did you receive your training?
Oh, my goodness gracious. I've been trained in all kinds of different fields, from television production and graphic design to theater and interpretive arts to meteorology and to climatology and all around. It's an interdisciplinary life that I lead. The basic training in meteorology came from my undergraduate work at Lyndon State College, and prior to that at Belknap College in Center Harbor, New Hampshire. And then I went and worked in the television business as a broadcast meteorologist for a number of years. Mm-hmm. It was when people started asking me questions back in the late 80s about this global warming thing, and I didn't really have any answers, that's when I decided to start doing some investigations. I was working the evening shift at that time, the 6 and 11 o'clock news, so I had all day free. Kids were all in school, so I decided to go back to school and try to learn a bit about that. And that's what led me to the what was the Quaternary Studies Institute at that time.
I see. So when did you first join the Institute?
My gosh, it's got to be 1989, 1990, anyway. Mm-hmm. I ended up meeting with Hal Borns. Had a nice meeting with him, and he suggested that, I wasn't too old to do it, and I could get started in classes, and we'll worry about the GREs later, and he introduced me to Kirk Mosh, who he was recommending to me as the chair of my committee, and off we went, off and running.
Mm-hmm. So you pursued a master's through the Institute for Quaternary Studies?
I did, exactly, and it was a rather interesting thesis. What I had proposed to do was I proposed to reconstruct a surface weather map from nothing but ephemeral evidence, diaries, newspapers, anecdotal evidence, not quantitative, but qualitative evidence. And it was tricky, but we got it done. And what happened was, it took so long for the committee to actually approve the thesis, I kept taking courses. I kept taking courses, and by the time they approved the thesis, I actually had enough courses under my belt to matriculate as a doctoral candidate. And all I needed to do was the doctoral thesis after that.
Mm. And did you expand upon your master's thesis for your
I certainly did. Yeah, the master's thesis was just basically a proof of concept. concept, showing that it could be done with a few examples from Central Maine and diaries from the 1940s. Hmm. But we couldn't immediately prove that, because at the time some of the surface maps were still classified from World War II. But I was able to get a hold of those maps and prove out what I had reconstructed. So that was a proof of concept. So we decided at that point to head back in time and see if we could make it work back then. And we decided, Kirk and I did, along with Dave Smith and Hal Morns, that based on what we had available for anecdotal evidence, that the year 1785 would suffice. We had some diaries that were just ending, some that were just beginning, and some that covered that area. And it was up to me to take what we had to start with, which were some references that Bob Barron had worked with, and go forward from there, expanding it out. And by the time I finished, I had recreated twice daily weather maps, diurnal maps for all of northeastern North America for the entire year 1785, and reconstructed the upper level flow as well. And nobody had attempted that up until that time. So we had something new and exciting, and that worked for a doctoral dissertation. We added a couple of people to the committee, and in 2004, I finally received the interdisciplinary PhD.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I was going to ask you if you had ever worked with Dave Smith, because I recall that that was something he was interested in, was reviewing old historical records for evidence of past climate.
He was very interested in that, was very happy to see the work. By bringing my synoptic meteorological talents to the table, years and years and years of making weather maps and working with them every day, and hand drawing them, that was what we needed to have to apply to this raft of information that we found, diaries, newspapers, and what have you, in order to get the job done.
Mm-hmm. And what did you do after earning your PhD?
Goodness. In my style of doing whatever needs to be done, I had been working in television up until that time, and it was time for change. So what I did was I accepted a few contracts with the Bermuda Weather Service as their lead forecaster, and worked with them off and on for 2 or 3 years. I also produced some television programming, a couple of shows on boating, which I've always wanted to do. And then eventually, I got a hold of, all this time I was applying to schools and colleges. And having such a scattershot resume, it was tough to find a job. But one finally opened up where I could actually be teaching not only meteorology and basic climatology, but also broadcast meteorology. And so I kind of fit right into that slot down here in Embry Riddle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so when did you land the position at Embry Riddle?
Began the spring semester of 2007, actually landed the job in 2006, came down over that Christmas holiday and started in January of 2007.
Mm-hmm. So, really not too long after earning your PhD.
No, actually not. I mean, I have to admit it was a very specialized kind of job and a specialized kind of resume that needed to fill it, so I wasn't in with a whole lot of other competition. But nevertheless, yeah, that's a pretty good deal to land a gig after just a few years, a couple of years, actually.
Yeah, yeah. So when you became a master's student at the Quaternary Institute, is that also when you became a member?
A member?
Mm-hmm.
A member of?
Of the Institute.
Oh, yeah, yeah. When I started, absolutely, yeah. I was working with those fellows right from day one, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't really an institute, per se. I mean, it was really just a cadre of researchers at the time. There was no application process. If you were a student, you were basically in it. that was.
Do you maintain regular contact with Institute members?
I did, yeah. I've stayed in contact with Hal in particular, and Kurt Mosh. See him regularly over the years. Yep.
Are you...
I always stop and say hi to Paul when I can, and feel very comfortable hanging around up there for sure.
How do you think the Institute has changed since you first got involved with it?
Well, it's certainly developed a worldwide reputation, that's for certain. Having Paul Lansky come up from UNH and all that he brought with him to expand the Institute and have it become the Climate Change Institute has been the envy of the world, really.
Are you actively researching right now?
As a professor, yes. You kind of have to. I'm off in many different directions. I have a talk to give next week to the American Association of Geographers about how different groups of people react to weather warnings differently, and how the news media can actually help in that situation as opposed to hindering the way it is right now. Mm-hmm. Also writing a plenary speaker for the Institute on Disaster Mental Health at the University of New Paltz at the end of the month. I'll be doing a talk up there also on how the media works and reacts to weather warnings. But I've also been publishing all kinds of other things. I mean, I've done an instructor's manual for a textbook. I'm still publishing on my forensic synoptic analysis techniques in different places, and that's always fun. And also working with some students with regards to the actual broadcast coverage. Some publications going and presentations at conferences for that, too. So, yeah, I continue to research for sure. Mm-hmm. I'd love to be able to take the time and expand my 1780s work out. But as I mentioned, there's so few people doing historical climatology in the United States. I mean, I can list them on one hand, as opposed to Europe, where there's now second and third generation researchers. There's dozens and dozens of them. Now, I'll have to admit that they have more to work with. They've got several records going back considerably longer than we have on in North America, but nevertheless, the number of researchers is way out of proportion. We should have more doing it here. Aren't that many doing it. If I win the lottery, I'll become a gentleman scientist like Dave was, and I'll just go ahead and do it.
As someone who's trained in historical techniques, it seems to me that probing the historical record for evidence of climate changes seems like a daunting task. I mean, where does one begin?
Well, if you look at it in the idea of researching the historical record for meteorological information, a lot easier to find references to weather than it is to find references to climate. Climate, of course, is nothing more than weather over a long period of time. Same stuff. So it's a lot easier when they're looking for records about people saying it was very cold today, or, you know, we had 12 inches of rain, or I had to chop a hole in my roof to get my daughter out by canoe because of the flooding and things like that. And then with some of the other records that we found, like the ships protest that I dug up in Bermuda. Nobody had published those or even used them in research before. We found a number of instances of hurricanes that aren't in the record. They aren't in the hurricane database. That's just exactly what we should be doing, is finding that information and putting it in with the information we already have to extend the record back further. Mm-hmm. Now, if you do that, then you're able to get a handle on how the climate has changed, because you can look at it over a longer period of time.
I see. Now, so you want information about weather. How do you decide what journals or what diaries to probe and what diaries maybe aren't worth the effort?
Most all diaries are. For some strange reason, most diarists start off by mentioning the weather. Now, I don't know if that's to get the ink flowing or to get the connection between the brain and the hand underway. But most diarists will mention the weather. And virtually every diarist will mention a strong weather event, a very severe weather event, and in great detail. So it's not a matter of figuring out which one to look at. It's a matter of how much weather information you can get out of anything you research.
Ah, I see. And so it seems that one of the goals is to gather a great deal of evidence from a number of different diaries.
Exactly. And with that information, I mean, remember now, we're not looking for specific observational data. So it's great if you can find that, but we're not looking for that. Where, you know, there's a thermometer or a barometer or something like that. We're looking for just people mentioning the weather. And with this technique of forensic synoptic analysis that's developed, you can take that information and you can plot it on a map just the same way you would plot a station model for a meteorological observation. And with things like trend analysis, you can basically recreate a weather map from that. With that, you can determine how far the polar cell has advanced or retreated, how far up the feral cell is, where's the polar front, what's the jet stream doing. That all comes from applying forecast methodologies in reverse.
Mm-hmm.
That's the principle of forensic synoptic analysis that I'm working with. If, for example, before a big snowstorm in the Northeast, I want to forecast heavy snow, I would look at four or five different criteria. I would look at the track of a vorticity maximum of 500 millibars, the location of the 1,300 geopotential meter line at 700 millibars, the location of the 0 degree isotherm at 850 millibars, all these criteria. If they do come together, you get heavy snow, period. So, if you get a number of observations of people saying, we got heavy, heavy snow, then you can infer, hindcast, that the 500 millibar flow was oriented this way, and 800 was this way, and on. See what I mean?
Yes, I see.
Now, by doing that, you can infer other things like, where's the basic climate gone? Where's it going? Some things don't happen in certain climate regimes. Some things do. What we found now is basically this 1785 is also a pretty good proxy for the middle of the Little Ice Age. And now we're seeing that this just this last winter, same kind of up-level flow that we discovered back in 1785, happening this year. What does that tell you? We headed back to a Little Ice Age? Something to think about.
Maybe, right.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So, you said that...
The most important thing that came out of all that work was I was able to actually hypothesize that the polar cell, that big yarmulke of cold air on the top of the Earth, if that moves in one direction or another, or expands, that says something about climate change. I was able to show that it actually slid preferentially towards North America instead of just expanding. And that is what people think might have been the situation not only during the last ice age, but at the beginning of the last ice age, the big ice age,
mm-hmm.
not just the little ice age. And it did jive pretty nicely with some of the broad brush results that Paul Majewski had gotten out of the ice cores, which was very nice to see.
Yeah.
When you can get scientists to arrive at the same conclusion using two different testable methods, that's huge.
Yeah. Why?
It simply validates the work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why does it tilt towards North America?
Well, that's a great question. See what I said about research? You know, to get a decent result, you answer one question, it gives you two more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the beauty of research. It just continues on.
Mm-hmm.
Now that I've been appointed as a research assistant professor at the working with the boys and girls up there to further these ideas and get more involved.
So, how do you see the Institute's role in affecting public opinion about climate change?
Well, just by virtue of its existence and the success in its work, that's going to help. I think what the Institute may need a bit more of is some communication mentoring. I mean, having people actually be charged with getting the word out and getting these people that are coming up with the results interviewed more often. The fact that the abrupt climate change is the latest, hottest research field, we'll need to know that. And in terms of communications, where I do have considerable experience, there's a 24-hour news cycle out here. You can get one little bit of information from a partial result of a very small study, and that's going to receive the same shrift as a six-person, six-year-long study and its results. So you have to keep hammering away at it to stay ahead of that 24-hour news cycle. Otherwise, your results are lost, and they end up immediately being compared with something that could be irrelevant and coming from a different source. So you need to stay completely ahead of that. I would say that the Institute is in a great position to develop that, and I look forward to perhaps helping them in that department, too.
What do you think has been the Institute's most important contribution to our understanding of climate?
Its wide interdisciplinary focus. There are a number of schools around the world where you can get people to concentrate on pollen analysis or deep ocean cores. There are fewer, but still a couple of schools that work with ice cores and the Arctic and the Antarctic. The fact that the Institute has expertise, continuing expertise, in all of the various paleoclimatic and climate proxies gives it a real advantage. And I think the fact they developed that early under the auspices of the Quaternary Studies Institute and have continued to develop that has put them way ahead of any other places.
So the interdisciplinary focus, is that advantageous because it makes it easier to do interdisciplinary research?
No, it's advantageous because good interdisciplinary research will come up with a result that you couldn't get from just studying one of the disciplines. See what I mean? Yeah. I mean, you can be a crack historian and find all these things in the books and the diaries and the newspapers that appear to relate to weather. But if you don't have a good synoptician or a good understanding of how the weather works, you're not going to be able to apply that information and come up with a result. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah.
So you have to have the expertise. Now, I'm not saying that everybody needs to be an expert in both fields. On the contrary, that's the beauty of the Institute. You've got people in all these different fields who can collaborate, and it makes it a lot easier to see a result that might not come out of just working in one single discipline. And the climate is a very complex scenario, too, so you need that kind of ability to be able to look above just a single discipline or a single course and be able to see the bigger picture and how things work.
Right. I think within the scientific community, there's no debate about the human role in climate change, but
absolutely none, and there hasn't been for a long time.
Right. But outside the scientific community and American political culture, it's still hotly debated. And I'm wondering if you can speculate as to why that is the case.
It's strictly political, entirely political. It's being run entirely by the same public relations and legal firms that did tobacco. It's the same thing. I'm not too terribly worried about it, and I'll tell you why. If you look outside the country, if you look anywhere outside the United States and perhaps Australia, everybody knows what's going on. Everybody's concerned about it. People are already deep into mitigation and adaptation techniques and plans. They're really the only country where we're dragging our feet. And it's obvious. It's a very Americo-centric thing. So it could only be political. Mm-hmm. And it has a lot to do with money, too. I mean, I spent a lot of time doing a television show called Made in Maine on public broadcasting. 19 years, as a matter of fact. And we went out visiting dozens, hundreds, actually, of different small businesses. And a businessman will, if they can make a couple of bucks, they'll change a process, they'll change a procedure, if it doesn't affect their quality or what have you. I remember once going down to what used to be called the S.D. Warren Company, a big, huge paper mill on the Penobscot River in Westbrook, Maine, now owned by Sappy, I think. And I know we were interviewing this chief officer down there about the environmental awards that he had been given in the last few months. Now, this was a paper mill that was notorious, stinking up the air, polluting the river. What happened is one of his engineers came up with an idea to close the system, the water system, on one of the paper-making machines and recycle some of that water to use in other machines, thereby saving some dollars. So the chief officer, of course, said, fine, great, we'll just do that. And then here come the environmental awards because they're not polluting the river anymore. He didn't have a clue what was going on. All he did was make a financial decision. And that's what needs to happen. If we can find ways for people who are doing the emissions to make more money by doing something else which reduces the emissions, they'll do it. No amount of browbeating is going to change that. So I think that's where having the information, solid information, would help. If there was some other interdisciplinary focus that I could imagine that would be connecting with the business community and the engineering community and finding ways to reduce emissions that saves the capitalist money, and they will make the decision, they'll do it. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something I would need to be thinking about for the future. Mm-hmm. Really, it isn't a hard problem. You talk to people in France or Switzerland or even the Netherlands are, you know, they've been 10, 15 years into their planning for adaptation and mitigation. Mm-hmm. We haven't even started.
So, I'm wondering if you can walk me through once again how you think the Institute can better get its information out to the general public.
Well, there's a number of ways you can do that. I mean, you know, you should probably be asking a professional public relations firm. I'm not that, but I mean, my first blush would be more publication in popular magazines and newspapers and articles, more outreach to the public, more short television productions, more affiliation with television and radio programs, more interactivity on the web. Well, there's plenty now, but more. That's the way to do it. I mean, then anybody can come and have a question answered and know why. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there's lots of other things that can be done to spread the word. But, the Institute is a research-based institute still. It's not set out for outreach. It's going to happen, though. I mean, it will happen. Mm-hmm. People will find out. They'll start coming to the they'll start coming for all kinds of answers, and we'll find out. So the Institute should be prepared for when that's going to happen.
So backing up.
Hopefully I can help with that. I'm looking forward to it.
So back to an earlier question I asked. You were a weather broadcaster here in Maine for a number of years.
Yeah, it continues for a long time. The radio for even longer. I'm doing radio. Still on Maine Public Broadcasting every Monday through Friday morning. Except tomorrow, because tomorrow is Pledge Day. Call in and pledge your $100 for the year on Thursday. I'll appreciate it. So will I.
I see. Now, how do you envision the remainder of your career unfolding?
Holy mackerel. It's probably going to end up in 12 different directions, just as it has so far. I hope to be able to continue researching and publishing. I would look forward to being able to collaborate, is what I mean to say, with other people in the field here in the United States and abroad. I do publish with some people in Europe from time to time. Continue to play music and see their kids and their grandkids and read books and read book reviews and you know, do some teaching and whatever, you know. Do some research.
Well, Lou, that's all the questions I have, but before we conclude the interview, I do want to give you a chance to maybe add something that I didn't think to ask you about.
I can't think of much. All I can say is that, having the institute there, the Institute of Quaternary Studies, and the welcoming attitude that Hal Borns had for me at the very beginning, as a non-traditional student, you understand, I had been years since I got my undergraduate degree, 10, 15 years, and say, no problem, come on, we'll get you started in the courses right away. That was just a godsend. It was a godsend, one of the turning points of my career, without doubt. And now to see where he has gone since then, and to be affiliated with them on a professional level instead of just as a student, it's a wonderful thing. I look forward to having that be another turning point and much left of my career. I'll put it that way. Other than that, I'm looking forward to come up with all these histories. I'd be very interested to see what you plan to do with the results and how you're going to correlate them or collate them or whatever.
Absolutely.
Sounds good.
Well, Lou, thank you very much for participating in this interview.
You're very welcome, Adam. Best of luck to you in the future.
I wish the best for you as well.
Nope.
Okay, take care.
Well said. Okay, have a great day.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks, Adam.